This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Ask Katie Anything. I'm your host, licensed marriage and family therapist, Katie Morton. I'm so glad that you're here. In this week's episode, I'm going to discuss the line between normal sibling relationships and what we would call emotional abuse. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about shutting down in therapy, why it can happen, what we can do, and how to know if we're oversharing in our relationships or in therapy. Then I'm going to talk about how mental illnesses can sometimes follow patterns in their symptomology, why we can struggle with self-care, and finally, our urge to diffuse situations with laughter. Without further ado, let's jump into question number one. This question says, hi, Katie, where is the line between normal sibling relationships and emotional abuse? My therapist seems to think that my sister is emotionally abusive, but aren't all siblings assholes to each other? And there's another comment says, I wonder the same thing. My siblings called me fat or acne face when I was a child. When does it start to be considered bullying? These are great questions. And the truth about it is that, yes, siblings can be jerks and like take your stuff without asking and call you the annoying little sister or little brother or, ugh, get out of my room. Like the kind of things that I would call our exploration into boundary setting. We overstep boundaries. We tell people to get out, right? It's that push-pull that I don't really know. And of course, it's family. We can lose our cool, yell at them, be upset, all that kind of stuff. But when it comes to like belittling, destroying property, name calling, threatening, intimidating, criticizing us, any of that is technically abuse, technically emotional abuse, or what we would call, you know, you could even just, if you wanted to say lighter because abuse sounds too strong, you could say that's when your relationship dynamic with your siblings is toxic. And I know for a lot of people, they're like, but aren't all siblings jerks? Don't we all talk to each other that way? No, we actually don't. And even my brother and I, we didn't like necessarily, weren't like the best of friends or anything like that. He's also way older than me, like almost 4 years. So he was just into different things. I was probably that annoying little sister that wanted to tag along. He would say stuff like that sometimes, or his friends would be like, ugh, does she have to come? You know, and he'd be like, go back home. You know, that kind of stuff is pretty normal. He never bullied me. He never told me I was stupid or fat or ugly or any of that stuff. There was never any really name calling or criticizing or belittling. It was more like, you're so annoying. Get out of here, right? Like, stop bothering me. And so there is a difference. And I want you to be thoughtful about how you assess your own relationships. Is there criticizing, belittling, name calling, threatening? Was there destruction of property or any of those things, right? Think about it in the real definitions of those terms. Because often when we grow up in a situation where we're treated one kind of way, that becomes really normal. And so we tend to assume, well, everybody's sisters, brothers, or whatever are like this. But that's just not the case. If you find this happening, talk to one of your parents. Talk to, you know, hopefully you can get in to see a therapist or something like that to get some support, but it's not okay. And it shouldn't be supported in your home. Your parents should put a stop to it. It shouldn't be an acceptable way to talk to one another or treat one another. And it technically falls into the line of emotional abuse. And I would consider the relationship extremely toxic until we can get a better handle on this. And so the line is really between like kind of that boundary pushing, boundary setting space. And when we're actually like shit talking someone, putting them down, you know, destroying their things, taking something that they love and not giving it back. Like those are, I know that, again, we've normalized a lot of that behavior, but it's not normal and it's not okay. And it really crosses that line. And I know it's kind of hard to maybe feel where that line would be, but just go back to what I said, the words I use, like if they're name calling, criticizing, intimidating, threatening you, belittling you, destroying property, obviously there can be physical abuse too. Like if they're hitting, biting, pushing you. Now, yes, there's going to be times when we fight with them, we argue, but if this is constant and this is kind of the dynamic and the way that they treat you and your other siblings, possibly, you know, pay attention to that. We can all have one-offs where we don't really get along and we get into this fight and blah, 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 we hate you, blah, and we get mad. But if that's just how they interact with you, that's the way they think is okay. And if you put up any fight, they're, you know, then maybe it turns physical. Like, that's not okay. That's abusive. And it shouldn't be acceptable just because you're siblings or just because there's only a small age gap. Unfortunately, a lot of times we think like, oh, kids will be kids and, you know, the boys will be boys. They'll name call, or girls can be really ruthless. That doesn't make it less abusive. We shouldn't condone that behavior. We shouldn't act like it's okay. And so that's when it really turns into bullying, when it's more than just that, what I would call quote unquote normal boundary pushing and setting. Okay. So if we find it to, we like dread being around them. The things that they've said have caused us to feel some kind of shame or embarrassment about who we are, what we look like. That's not good. Okay. I wish there was like a better definitive, like when it happens this way, but that's just, think of those terms that I mentioned and the definitions that you'd give to them, or look up the definitions and you can decide for yourself. Okay. Let's move on to question number two. This question says, hi, Katie. My question is about shutting down in therapy and being able to talk during a therapy session. Recently, I've been looking for a new therapist, but I haven't been able to find someone that I'm comfortable with. It can take a while. The problem is that in the first 1 to 2 sessions, I shut down and feel unable to talk. Different therapists handle this differently, but for the most part, they just let me sit there. I've spent entire sessions in shutdown mode and we just sit there doing nothing. This seems to perpetuate the idea that talking is unsafe and obviously tells my body that being in this environment is unsafe. I am scared to continue searching for a new therapist because I don't want to be triggered again and shut down. How would you handle a client that shuts down in session, especially one that is newer to you? How can I begin to feel safe in a new therapeutic relationship if I shut down almost immediately upon seeing a new therapist? And this is a great question. First, I want to address the reasons that we can shut down, because the person here mentions being triggered. And when we're seeking out therapy, let's say we haven't even been in therapy before, when we seek it out at the beginning, we might not even know how reactive we could feel. We might not know the emotional toll that being in therapy can place on us. And we can get there and they ask us like 1 or 2 questions and we're like, we dissociate, we shut down, we feel maxed out. We cannot participate. And any of that overwhelm, that intense feeling of stress or that intense feeling of anxiety or a trauma response, dissociation, can cause us to shut down in therapy. Not to mention the fact that therapy is kind of a weird thing, right? We go in, we talk to a stranger about our most intimate and icky details. It's stressful for anybody. It's difficult for anybody. And so that's really kind of why I find shutdowns happen in session. Also, the fact if we're doing trauma work as we move through therapy, we can get into really tricky, difficult things, and that can cause a shutdown too, especially if the therapist doesn't realize how emotionally charged it is for us and we go too much too fast. We can shut down. Now, with that understanding, let's move into these questions. It says, how do you handle, or how would you handle a client that shuts down in session, especially one that's newer to you? I have various ways. Now, there's a couple of things. I have had patients shut down where I just let it sit for the entire session. And yes, I know it's uncomfortable. Yes, I know it's shitty, but these are clients I've been seeing for a while who we have worked extensively on grounding techniques and on managing their dissociation. And because many of you know, I deal a lot with eating disorders and people with self-injury urges and borderline personality disorder. Some of that can be kind of manipulative. And I don't mean that as not put down, just hang with me. We can manipulate to assuage some kind of anxiety. And when we have BPD, a lot of what we do is to help us better manage that fear of abandonment. And I've had patients who will use their kind of dissociation and tapping out as an escape or as a way to pull me in more. And so when we work a lot on using these coping skills and these grounding techniques, and then they have an opportunity to, at the beginning, when I feel them leaving reality, I can see them dissociating or shutting down, I'll mention, use your tools. We've talked about this, remember, and I'll talk them through a few of them, and then I'll let them sit because I want them to try to work that muscle, right? If therapy doesn't challenge you, and if I, as a therapist, come in to save you each and every time, then I'm really not setting you up for success. So it's a balance. So with my patients, if I've been seeing them for a while, that means we would have worked on this. We would have identified that this is happening. This is an issue. And I would up front, when I could feel them going, I would remind them, hey, don't forget to use your tools. Remember. And then I start talking through. Remember, number one was that we were going to look around the room. Can you make Can you identify something in the room that's black? Look around. Can you do that? And if I don't see their eyes wandering, then I might draw attention to them and say, hey, can you feel your pants on your body? Do you feel your back against the chair, your butt into the sofa, or your feet on the ground? Like, go through some different things. I might offer to get them some ice water. There are a couple things I will do, and then I'll let them sit. And I know that people might think, Katie, that's really hurtful, or, oh, that feels so icky. But we have to get, oh, sorry, Roxy's barking at nothing. We have to give our patients an opportunity to use the tools. That's the whole goal, is for you not to be dependent upon me, right? So that's what I would do. Now, if someone was new to me and I didn't know this, I would probably talk for longer about grounding techniques and trying to get them to use, you know, this, that, or the other, like counting colors. I would probably guide them more because they don't know them, right? And if we could get them to successfully come out of it, then I would ask them what they would want me to do, because if I wasn't prepared, I wouldn't know what's okay. Like, some of my patients are like, hey, please come, you know, can you grab my arm or rub my back? Other people are like, that's going to be make it way worse. Please don't do that, right? But I don't know, so I'm not going to do anything that could potentially re-traumatize them or make them more uncomfortable. And so that would really, that'd be the beginning of that conversation, okay? Now, for you, we're going to have to do some homework before we go back in, because you need to have some grounding techniques available. We need to have some fidget toys or tools or things that we can do so that we don't just boop, check out and miss the whole session. So it's not even, we don't even know if we like them. It's not going to be helpful. We're going to have to keep going for, like, we're wasting a lot of time and money, right? And energy. And so here are some grounding techniques I want you to try on your own and see which ones feel the best to you. Now, I know you might be saying, but I'm not shutting down right now. Trust me when I tell you that as you do them, you'll notice the ones that take your mind off of the stressful thing the best, okay? Meaning that you'll probably feel a little bit more relaxed or so distracted that you don't feel any dysregulation. Even if it's not to the point where it's pulling you out, and you're dissociating or shutting down, you'll notice the ones that take the most energy or focus from you, okay? Now, some very popular grounding techniques that have worked for me and my patients are counting colors. How many things in the room are blue, brown, black, white? Tell me, how many things are blue? Start there. And how many things are black, right? Go through them. You can also do the alphabet. Look around the room for things that start with the letter A. What about the letter B, C, D, and so on? If those are really difficult and you're like, I can't do that, then maybe we need to have a fidget in our hands. I'm a huge fan of Thinking Putty. You can get it on Amazon. They also have really big tins of it that you can really play. Like, I like that it's like a little bigger than Silly Putty, but Silly Putty's cheaper. So you can go to Walmart and get like 3 or 4 little eggs of Silly Putty for just a few bucks. So depending on your budget, I think Thinking Putty, last time I purchased it, for the small tin was like $5. And the big tin, I think, is like 10. So anyway, get something in your hands, even if it's like rubber bands or hair ties you put on your wrist. It could be a ring that's a fidget. Like, a lot of rings will have like spinners in them. Whatever will work for you. Another thing that is incredibly helpful for so many of my patients, people in general, cold, cold water. Now, I know you're in therapy, so I don't know how accessible this can be, but if you can have like an ice pack in your pocket and you can put it in your hands, it's cold, put it on your neck. Those little Breakum ice packets that we put into first aid kits can be incredibly helpful on the go. If you're at home and it's virtual, then have like a cold rag sitting in like ice water next to you. You can wring it out, put it on your face, put it on your neck. You can have cold water like in your water bottle, like just ice with a little bit of water, and drink that, and that can help bring you back. So those are some of the things. Or you can do a check-in. In DBT, we call it like the white light. And you imagine like the circle of white light coming down over your whole body, and you pay attention to how it feels as it happens. So like coming over your head and your eyes and your nose, you feel it hit your mouth and your neck, and you're just checking in. Now, that might be too much. It depends on, you know, why we're shutting down, if we have trauma, stuff like that. But that can be a way to get back in your body as well. Those are just a couple of the tools that can work. So give them a try, because my whole goal for you would be to build up that muscle of grounding techniques, so that when we feel this, like, I'm gonna shut down, we can use them and we can fight to stay present. And it might be something that you say to a new therapist before you see them. Like, when you're making the appointment, maybe we call and do a free consultation on the phone and we let them know. or maybe we email them, or maybe, you know, whatever we can do to let them know ahead of time, because then we're giving them a heads up. We can even say, hey, I've been trying these tools. Some of these work, some of these don't. And they can help guide us there too. That's another great way to try to manage this too. Okay. But you're not alone. It's incredibly common. Most therapists will do something. I would never let a new patient just sit there the whole time. I would at least, and I always at least try to bring you back at the beginning, but I can't do it for you, you know? So there are limits. Okay. Let's move on to question number 3. This question says, hi, Katie. Sorry, this question is super general, but I'm just wondering if you can talk a bit about oversharing. I feel like it's a relatively new term to me, and I'm wondering how to tell if someone is doing it. Is it okay to have some people we tell literally everything to, even when it's like TMI, or it stands for too much information if you don't know? Or are there some things that should always be private? In cases where I've decided someone is sharing too much with us and we feel uncomfortable, how do we communicate this? Can you share some tips on setting boundaries without being mean? For example, it seems rude to tell someone to stop talking or to walk away, but I often find myself getting trapped in conversations I don't want to be a part of, you and me both, and getting dumped on, and I don't know how to stop it without feeling like a jerk. LOL. Thanks so much. I love your podcast. Of course. And we have a follow-up on this one, but let's talk a little bit about oversharing. Now, it's not a definitive line. I can't say, oh, if you're sharing X, Y, and Z, then that's bad, and this should always be private, or that shouldn't. It's really up to you. And I find that, unfortunately, people who desperately need therapy and who have no knowledge of boundaries tend to dump on other people. And they don't realize they're doing it. It's kind of an unconscious thing because they essentially have no awareness of what's right and what's not right, because probably growing up, their boundaries were not respected. They felt like they couldn't trust their own boundaries, so they look out to others, and they probably felt like there was no safe space to share anything, or it was everything or nothing. You know, there was no balance, no healthy communication in their life. That's why they do it. Okay. Also, we can do trauma dumping if we have trauma, and that could happen for that reason as well. And trauma, we all know, you know, was filled with shame and embarrassment and guilt, and we cannot really feel like we know how to interact in our environment. Okay, now that we've kind of addressed that, when it's happening, I think of oversharing as a good check-in is if we know the same about them. Like, there's kind of this give and take, this ebb and flow, this you share, I share, you talk, I talk, in friendships and in relationships and as they build. Now, everybody's level of comfort is going to be different, but I encourage you to spend a little time thinking about the layers of friendship and what information you would offer up to those people. And I know this sounds maybe kind of tedious, but it's an important practice for all of us so that we can recognize what's okay, what's not okay, what causes us to feel like we've trauma dumped, what makes us shut down, when do we think other people are dumping? Because if we don't have an idea of what's okay and not okay for us, then how do we expect to communicate that to other people, right? We can't. So take some time and consider, and I'll give you some of my own ideas. Now, if I just met someone, because my job is so weird and I don't want people looking me up online, I often don't even tell them what I do for a living for a little while, not for a long time, but for a little while. But, you know, I would tell them that I'm married. I would tell them about Roxy. I would tell them, you know, I'm new to the Austin area. I would tell them that I'm a therapist, but I wouldn't give any more information other than that. And sometimes I don't even want to share that if I'm like at a cocktail party, because sometimes people will dump on me. So that's where I start. Then let's say I've hung out with someone a few times, then I might let them in on like what I do. I might tell them, you know, I might, if depending on where conversations go, I might say, oh yeah, and my mom just moved out here. Oh yeah, and my dad passed away when I was 24. You know, I might give little bits of things along the way. But then as things develop, like then let's say we become like closer friends and we spend a lot of time together, then I might share things about my own therapeutic work that I'm doing in, you know, with my therapist, or the things that I'm worried about, or the fact that I don't really feel like I fit in here. Like, I might share more about me and my process. And you can see how this kind of, there's a deep, you're going deeper into me and who I am and how I operate and what I think. And it's slow and steady as the trust is built. Now, We have to figure out what that feels like for us and also recognize that we probably have our own, like, maybe anxious, avoidant attachment stuff or our own overshare urges, right? We can push, pull. We can have our own stuff, but we have to think about it. And often we don't identify it or know we're doing it until we do this kind of work. So what are the layers of friendships for you? What do you kind of share, not share? And if you looked at a friendship, so with each of those levels, I encourage you to try to think of a friend or an acquaintance that you have at that level and ask yourself, do I know this stuff about them? What have they told me? Just to kind of gauge whether we're on the same page or not, okay? So I know that's a lot, but that's really a big piece of this. And then how do we communicate? Now, this is like something that I do all the time. How do we communicate when someone's oversharing? Now, to be truthful, if we're not that close with them, it's not up to us to tell them they're oversharing. It's up to us to shut that conversation down and leave, okay? Yes, it's rude, I agree, to just like walk away. That's not really what I do. And I have a ton of practice with this because it happens all the time, especially at YouTube conventions and things like that, because other creators know that I'm a therapist and I end up inevitably being pulled into a lot of drama. So what I do is I reiterate what they've said. So when there's a break in conversation, or if there's not, I kind of cut them off and say, man, that must be hard, right? We want to validate. We're going to kind of hug and roll, okay? We validate. Man, that must be so hard. I'm so sorry you're going through that. Unfortunately, I've really got to go to the bathroom. I need to go to the bathroom. I have to head out. I have an early morning tomorrow. Before I even get to events, I have ideas of how to get out of those types of conversations. Bathroom, Sean will come and save me a lot, or one of my friends will come and save me. That's always helpful. And I always say something like, I'm so sorry to cut this short. It was lovely to meet you. I'll hope to see you next time. And I walk away. Or I validate, that must be so tough. I'm sorry you're going through that. I'm so sorry, Rick, but I am going to have to go. I'll see you next time. So lovely to meet you. Always just like a nice, warm, this has been wonderful. It's great to meet you. It's great to see you again. I'm sorry you're going through that. Take care and we'll talk again soon. And you just kind of push it out and you leave. Now, if you're going to make that cut and run and you're going to come back to the party, you have to make sure that your excuse was something like the bathroom or, oh, I have to make a quick call. I forgot I have to call, I check in with my husband, my friend, my manager, my whoever. I'm going to go make a call and I'll be right back. And that's fine. You don't have to find them again. You said, I'll be right back. You don't wait for me. You're not like, wait here. I'll be back. Just say, I'll see you in a little bit. I'm going to head out. I'll be back in a bit. Very loosey goosey. So there's no need for you to let them know they're oversharing. I feel like that makes it more awkward. In the past, I've tried to do stuff like that and it doesn't end up panning out because the relationship isn't that close, which is why it's oversharing. And so to try to communicate that without hurting their feelings can be impossible because we don't really know them that well. I find it's better to just validate, acknowledge the upset or whatever they're saying. Oh, I'm so sorry your relationship is not doing so well. That's such a bummer. I'm so sorry for you. Or I feel so bad for you. Or, oh, that must be so tough. We just validate. And then be like, I've really got to run. It was lovely to meet you. And it's going to feel a little awkward, but that's not on you. You're just trying to carefully and caringly end the conversation. So that's my advice. And just consider some of the ways that you can get out of stuff like that. Oh, you know what? My break is up. I got to go. I'm so sorry. But best of luck on that. Keep me posted. You can just say some things and walk away because it's not up to us to educate them. The people that we could educate would be like our close, close friends. And chances of them oversharing are pretty low. But we could mention in passing at a later time, hey, we went to this like cocktail party with our friends, and I noticed, are you really close with, I don't know, Roxanne? I'd be like, no, I'm not that close with her. Why? Oh, I heard you sharing like some really personal stuff. And I thought maybe your relationship was more intense than I realized. We can draw some attention to it. But again, all within our comfort level, that's for a close friend. And that would be because we noticed them oversharing with someone else, but it's not our duty to teach them. Okay. Now, there was a comment on this. It says along the same lines of oversharing, but branching off a bit. How do you manage oversharing with your therapist? My therapist has stressed that some people need to tell her every little detail and some people don't want or need to. And I can't visualize things. So I find telling him every little detail helps. That's wonderful. But I feel like it comes across as asking for attention as a pity party, which I'm not trying to make it come across as. I'm going to be honest here. You cannot overshare with your therapist. I know that's hard to acknowledge or let sit, but it's the truth. We cannot overshare with our therapist because their whole goal is to assist us. And the more information or the more detail they have, the better able they'll be to help. It's almost like if you're telling someone to find, you're like, go into my closet and can you grab me a pair of, you can grab me that pair of jeans. Someone gets into your closet, they're like, you got a fuck ton of jeans in here. I don't know which ones you're talking about, right? As opposed to if I was like, hey, okay, so I have this dark denim pair in my closet. It's on the second row, fourth over, and they're Madewell brand. Can you go get those for me? Right? That's so much easier. And I know that's a weird analogy, but that's how therapy works. If we don't tell our therapist exactly what's going on in as much detail as possible, it's going to be harder for them to find the problem with us, help us identify it, and help us work through it. And so you cannot overshare. But I would let your therapist know that you're experiencing this concern over like needing of attention and like you're throwing a pity party, because my belief is that that's coming from like an old story. Maybe when we were growing up, someone told us like, oh, there she is again, just doing everything for attention, or oh, she's a one-woman pity party show or whatever, right? We might have heard some trash talking in that way. And that's why that's coming up. But we need to let them know that we are experiencing this so they can check in on it for us and help us overcome it too. Okay. Let's move on to question number four. This question says, Katie, why is it the case that mental illnesses, quote unquote, follow patterns in the sense that they can be categorized into illnesses? Like, why is it natural to get addicted or to get an eating disorder when something is missing in life? Like, why are these patterns natural consequences that happen for so many people, even if one does not know of the existence of these illnesses? It is fascinating. And I wish I had like a better research-based theoretical answer. But I have my own theories. I have my own theoretical answer. And my belief is that we follow patterns because as humans, we're incredibly adaptive and we use the resources that we have. Now, there's a couple pieces to this because we cannot control other people in our lives, right? And most of us don't grow up with a parent who shows us how to properly identify and process our emotions. And so we struggle to understand why we're having such a hard time. We try to make sense of it. And what do we do when we don't have full evidence or full stories of what's going on? We blame ourselves. And then we can only control ourselves. So then we take it internal. And internal ways that we can harm ourselves, I mean, you could say that the ideas are endless, but there's very common ones like addiction, eating disorder, self-injury, right? Those are just some of the ways. Overspending, sex addiction, right? There's things that we do. And it's because of that lack of other ways to cope, of other resources. It always comes back to us and how we kind of sabotage ourselves or harm ourselves as a way to numb out from the thing that we don't want to think about, or the thing that's so uncomfortable or so embarrassing or so shame-filled that we can't talk about it. And that's why they end up following patterns. And I always just see it as our brain's way of trying to deal as best it can with what's going on. And not to mention, then let's get into the second component of this, genetics. Now, I come from a long line of anxious women. So it's no surprise that I find myself more on the anxious side of things, right? So there's genetic predispositions. And I know I don't talk enough about this. It's because I'm not a geneticist and I'm not a neurologist. I can't, you know, there's limitations to what I can with ease explain. But we do know, for example, if we have people in our direct family lineage, like once or twice removed, so meaning like our brother, our mother, our grandma, like someone in there, had bipolar disorder, we have an 80% higher chance of having it ourselves. We're 80% more likely to have it. If we have parents who both have schizophrenia, we're 50% more likely. If we have anxiety in our family, I want to say it increases our risk by 28%. And don't quote me on all those exact percentages. Those are just off the top of my head. But the reason I bring this up is because mental illnesses follow patterns in this way, because most of us have some addiction in our family somewhere. I want to say this is years ago, but I swear I read an article, like a research article, saying that it was something like 87% of people had addiction somewhere in their families. And I would argue it's probably like 100%, because somewhere in there, somebody was doing something. Often it was, you know, hush, hush. So It's in our genetic predisposition. Therefore, when our brain goes looking for ways to cope, that seems comfortable. Not to mention society, right? Think of eating disorders and addiction and how prevalent they are in society, because marketing tells us we need to look one kind of way. And if we want to be happy, we should buy this kind of thing. Overspending, shopping addiction, right? Sex sells, there's porn and stuff like that. Sex addiction, right? And then we look at like how big of a role alcohol plays in a lot of social interactions. So it's normal to start drinking. Okay, well, wow, then I feel kind of better. Maybe I'm going to drink a little more, right? And I know that this, it can feel like it's very random, like it just out of nowhere. I don't know why I decided to do this. I don't know why so many people struggle with this. I don't know why it follows these patterns, because of the way our society is kind of put together, the way marketing works, the our accessibility, how easy is it for us to get certain things, right? We don't, I know that we have like an opioid crisis in our world in general, and drug addiction is real, but I would argue that we have more people who have an alcohol addiction than we do heroin, for example, just because it's not part of our society as a whole. It's not like socially acceptable, and it's hard to get, and probably it's expensive. I don't know, but you know what I'm saying? Like, so think of these things, and that's why it's like quote unquote natural or normal or so common for people to, you know, get addicted or have an eating disorder or start self-injuring or have a sex addiction, shopping addiction, things like that. Because that's what we have access to, and that's what we can control. And that's what our society kind of tells us we should move towards. Does that make sense? I hope so. Let me know. Happy to do a follow-up. But that's why, that's my belief. Okay. Let's move on to question number 5. This question says, hey, Kate, I hope you're taking care of yourself. I am. I feel like I'm in a time of transition personally. I won't talk about it as much here. I could talk about it more later if you're interested. But I am feeling better. I've been like giving myself a little more care and support and moving slower, which I know sounds silly, but I'm quite intense, you guys. I can be pretty hardcore. And I've been trying to give myself a little breathing room lately, and it has felt good. This person says, my question is, why do I have trouble engaging in self-care and having a hard time finding coping skills that work for me? I have things that I have enjoyed doing in the past, but I just can't seem to do any of them. Can I count TV watching and internet scrolling as self-care? No, but we'll talk about this. I know I need some coping skills if I want to deal with childhood trauma. Not sure I want to go there. Can coping skills also be self-care and vice versa? Yes. Okay. Couple things. Now, self-care is hard for a myriad of reasons, but the ones that I run into the most, especially because so many of you are so lovely and gracious of sharing your stories, and you've helped me see and gain a deeper understanding as to why this can feel impossible when we have trauma in our past. Now, I talked a lot about how when we have trauma, that means that we also have shame. And shame is something's wrong with me. I'm broken inside, right? It's not embarrassment. It's not guilt. It's not the same as that. It's something's wrong with me. Because that correlation is so tight between trauma and shame, then when I, as a therapist, I'm like, well, you need to take better care. It's self-care. You should do something kind to yourself. You're like, but I'm broken. Something's wrong with me. I don't even like myself. Why would I want to take care of myself? Like, essentially, what the hell are you talking about? How am I supposed to do that? But people don't talk about this enough. How difficult it is when we're struggling with our own self-worth and our own shame and our own angst and upset and trauma. The idea of doing something kind for ourselves just feels wrong, feels bad. It's like ego dystonic. We don't like it, right? Ooh. And so that's why I think it's hard for you to do any of this. Self-care may not quite feel attainable at this juncture. And so my encouragement for you is to, we're going to reframe, and we're not going to call it self-care anymore. I want you to call it basic needs. And the reason I call it basic needs is because needs has a very different feeling than self-care or wants or desires. That can feel very luxurious, very unattainable, or like we have to love ourselves. It feels luxurious, right? So instead, we're going to say basic needs. And I want you to focus on showering regularly, drinking water, taking your medication as prescribed, eating balanced meals. And when I say balanced, I don't mean a diet. I mean, I want you to have some protein. I want you to have some carbohydrate. I want you to have some fruit or veg, just to balanced. I want you to eat till you're full. Stop there. Eat when you're hungry. Stop when you're full. Those are the things I want you to focus on. We can move into self-care later. But I even hold myself accountable to the fact that I didn't make that connection until a wonderful member of our community shared about her difficulty with this. So that's why you're having a hard time would be my hypothesis. So let's focus on those basic needs. And TV watching and internet scrolling, I would call those distraction-based coping skills. You can still put them in there. They're fine, but they don't actually help us process. Now, I have a video that I want you to look up. Look up 25 coping skills, Katie Morton. It's old. People have told me to redo that video. I just might. But it offers distraction-based coping skills and process-based coping skills. And the reason that I broke them into those two kinds of buckets is because sometimes we're so queued up, so upset, so filled with shame, so overwhelmed that to do a process-based coping skill, something like an impulse log or journaling or calling and talking to a friend in a real way is going to feel unattainable. We're not there. We're already overwhelmed. And so we need to distract. We need those distraction-based coping skills first, things like walking the dog or organizing a closet or painting our nails or taking a bath or any number of other things like that. They're just kind of coloring. We're distracting so that we can take that emotional dysregulation down to a level where then we can do the process-based ones. Does that make sense? And so, you know, you can utilize them in different ways, and TV and internet scrolling isn't ideal, but it is a distraction. And so put it down there and we can use it, but then we need to move into the more process-based ones as we start to feel less dysregulated, I guess. And the last part of this question said, can coping skills also be self-care and vice versa? Yes, they can, 100%, because they're ways that we are taking care of our emotional well-being, right? And it like I said, there's distraction ones and then there's process ones, and they're all ways of caring for ourselves and our recovery. And I think that is it. Yes, those are all your questions, but let me know if you have any follow-ups. That's so incredibly common. I think we have to just start talking about it differently, and I'll do my best to do that going forward. Final question, question number six says, hi, Katie. So I'm an awkward laugher. My way of diffusing situations used to be to make them lighthearted. That was literally my role. It's so ingrained in me now that it's just instinctive what I go to, even when it's not really appropriate. I feel like I've also used it so much in every part of my life that I don't really feel anything. Everything is just a big joke. I feel like I physically can't stop it now. I don't even know where to begin in correcting this, or if it's even fixable. Oh, fixable now. So any tips would be appreciated. Of course. Now, for anybody who feels like they laugh at inappropriate times and they're like their affect, meaning the way you express yourself through your like facial expressions, body, all of that. If you feel like that's always off and you cry when you want to laugh and you laugh when you want to cry, and it just feels very not connected, like what in the hell is going on? That could be, and that's not what this person's talking about, but I just wanted to bring it up. It could be something called a pseudobulbar affect. And that could be caused through a TBI or traumatic brain injury, but you can look up pseudobulbar affect. It's PSEUDO and then space BULBAR and affect. You can look that up. It's something, obviously, I'm not a neurologist, but that's where this issue comes from. And a lot of people with pseudobulbar affect can find themselves like not able to emotionally express themselves properly. And it could be due to a tumor in your brain or TBI or something like that. Now, in this case, it sounds like exactly like you explained it to me, that like this was your role. This was literally your role growing up. And so you don't really know how to manage uncomfortable emotions. It might have been not okay in your family to be sad or to be mad when you were growing up. And so therefore you could feel like it's not appropriate, and you need to do what you were supposed to do and make it lighthearted. Make everybody laugh. That's what you got to do, right? And that's the only thing you know how to do. That's how you've probably identified or defined yourself, really. And so breaking out of that pattern is going to take some work and some effort, but let your therapist know that this is something that you're doing that you don't like. You're like, I don't know why I do this. It's not appropriate. It drives me crazy. And I just don't really know how to like fix it. Now, my best advice is to start noticing, because we have to understand something first, right? Be curious, not judgmental. so that we can decide how we want to act. Because otherwise, we're going to just knee-jerk go into it, right? So you could even look back on like the last time you felt like you did this and kind of feel it out and maybe start being curious about that emotional response. What came up for you? When, if you were able to identify, when did you feel the urge to make a joke or to lighten the mood? When did that happen? And what were you experiencing yourself? Is it because you felt this emotion strongly and you didn't like it? Are we running from our own emotions too, which is possible? What was the emotion? Could we identify it? See, so we're going to slowly but surely try to get to know your process. I know we always want like a quick fix. We want to know how to like, I don't like doing this. How do I stop? We can get there and you can stop acting in this way. But like anything, we have to understand it first. It served a purpose for your whole life. And so we can't just take it away, right? It's that Chesterton's fence I've referenced in the past. We can't just take it away. We have to understand it so that then we can remove it. Because you might not be okay if you don't make a joke. The discomfort might get so great that you, I don't know, dissociate, have a panic attack, have to leave the room. I don't know. Or you might feel really awkward and say something else that you regret. I don't know. We have to understand where this is coming from so we can replace it with something that feels, it's going to be uncomfortable, but just a little bit better, right? And then maybe instead of making a big joke or making a laugh or like pulling people's attention, maybe we're able to just remove ourselves for a minute, or we're able to just, you know, bring up a topic that's not as stressful. And we change the subject. I don't know. But there are ways that we're going to have to shift little by little. But don't rush yourself, because you've been doing this for a really, really long time. I know it's frustrating. I know you don't like doing it. But let's do our research, figure out where it comes from, how long we've been doing it, what emotions were we experiencing last time. Let's just dig in there to figure out where this urge comes from, because then we can decide to act differently. But we don't have any space in there to even decide right now because we don't really understand it. So do some of your own personal research, be a detective about it, and then report back. Okay? I think that was it. Yes, that's the last question. Thank you all so much for listening and watching this week. Thank you for sharing the podcast. It really, really does help. Have a wonderful rest of your week. Do your homework, and I'll see you next time. Bye.